inside that house.
Huh? A terrifying thought, confirmed Behemoth.
Yes, continued Korovyov. One can expect astonishing things from the seed beds of this house, under whose roof have gathered thousands of devotees selflessly resolved to dedicate their lives to serving Melpomene, Polyhymnia, and Thalia. Just imagine what a sensation it will be when, for starters, one of them presents the reading public with an Inspector General, or, at the very least, a Eugene Onegin.
I can easily imagine that, again confirmed Behemoth.
Yes, continued Korovyov, and raised a cautionary finger. But, I say, and I repeat it, but only if some microorganism doesn't attack these tender hothouse plants and eat away at their roots. Only if they don't rot. And that can happen with pineapples. Oh, yes, indeed it can. By the way, said Behemoth in an inquiring tone, sticking his round head through a hole in the railing, what are they doing there on the veranda?
They're dining, explained Korovyov. I forgot to mention, dear fellow, that there's a rather decent and inexpensive restaurant here, and it just so happens that I, like any tourist about to begin a long journey, would like a bite to eat and a large, frosty mug of beer.
Me too, replied Behemoth.
And the two scoundrels set off along the asphalt path under the lindens, heading straight for the veranda of the restaurant, which was as yet oblivious of the disaster to come. A pale and bored citizeness, in white socks and a white beret with a tassel, was sitting on a bentwood chair at the corner entrance to the veranda, where an opening had been created in the greenery of the trellis. In front of her, on a plain kitchen table, lay a thick, office-style register in which, for reasons unknown, she was writing down the names of those entering the restaurant. It was this citizeness who stopped Korovyov and Behemoth.
"Your ID cards?"
she asked, looking with astonishment at Korovyov's pince-nez and at Behemoth's primus stove and his torn elbow.
"I beg a thousand pardons, but what ID cards?" asked a surprised Korovyov.
"Are you writers?" asked the woman in turn.
"Of course we are," replied Korovyov with dignity.
"May I see your IDs?" repeated the woman.
"My charming creature," began Korovyov tenderly.
"I am not a charming creature," interrupted the woman. "Oh, what a pity," said Korovyov with disappointment, and he continued.
"Well, then, if you do not care to be a charming creature, which would have been quite nice, you don't have to be. But here's my point. In order to ascertain that Dostoevsky is a writer, do you really need to ask him for an ID? Just look at any 5 pages of any of his novels. And you will surely know, even without any ID, that you're dealing with a writer. And I don't suppose that he ever had any ID. What do you think?"
Korovyov turned to Behemoth.
"I'll bet he didn't,"
replied the latter, standing the primus stove on the table next to the register and wiping the sweat from his sooty brow.
"You are not Dostoevsky," said the citizeness, who was becoming addled by Korovyov.
"Well, but how do you know? How do you know?" replied the latter.
"Dostoevsky is dead," said the citizeness, but not very confidently.
"I protest," exclaimed Behemoth hotly. "Dostoevsky is immortal."
"Your IDs, citizens," said the citizeness.
"Excuse me, but this is, after all, absurd," said Korovyov, refusing to give in. "It isn't an ID that defines a writer, but what he has written. How can you know what ideas are fermenting in my brain or in his?"
And he pointed at Behemoth's head, whereupon the latter immediately removed his cap so that the citizeness could get a better look at it.
"Let people in, citizens," she said, already nervous.
Korovyov and Behemoth stepped aside and let some writer pass who was wearing a gray suit and a tieless white summer shirt, the collar of which was open and splayed over the collar of his jacket, and who had a newspaper tucked under his arm.
The writer gave the woman a friendly nod, scribbled something in the register she held out for him as he passed, and proceeded to the veranda.
"Alas, not to us," began Kuravyov sadly, "but to him will go that frosty mug of beer that we poor wanderers so dreamed of. Our situation is a sad and difficult one, and I do not know what to do."
Behemoth merely shrugged bitterly and put his cap back on his round head, which was covered all over with thick hair, very like cat fur. At that moment, a soft but commanding voice sounded above the woman's head. "Let them in, Sofia Pavlovna." The citizeness with the register gave a startled look in the greenery of the trellis. The white dress shirt and wedge-shaped beard of the pirate had appeared. He gave the two dubious ragamuffins a welcoming look, and even gestured for them to come inside. Archibald Archibaldovich made his authority felt in the restaurant he managed, and Sofia Pavlovna asked Kuravyov submissively,
"What is your name?"
"Pinayev," replied the latter politely. The citizeness wrote it down and looked questioningly at Behemoth.
"Skabichevsky,"
squeaked the latter, pointing at his primer stove for some reason. Sofia Pavlovna wrote that down too and pushed the register over to the guests to get their signatures. Kuravyov wrote Skabichevsky opposite Pinayev, and Behemoth wrote Pinayev opposite Skabichevsky. To Sofia Pavlovna's utter amazement, Archibald Archibaldovich smiled seductively and led the guests to the best table at the other end of the veranda, the table where there was the most shade and where the sunlight played merrily through one of the openings in the trellis. Blinking with astonishment, Sofia Pavlovna spent a long time studying the strange inscriptions left in the register by the unexpected visitors. Archibald Archibaldovich astonished the waiters as much as he had Sofia Pavlovna. He personally pulled the chair back from the table when inviting Kuravyov to be seated, winked at one waiter, whispered to the other, and both of the waiters then began fussing over the new guests, one of whom had put his primer stove down on the floor beside his rusty brown boot. The old tablecloth with yellow stains immediately disappeared from the table, and another one, as white as a Bedouin's burnous and crackling with starch, billowed in the breeze, while Archibald Archibaldovich leaned over and whispered softly but expressively into Kuravyov's ear, "What can I get for you? I have some choice smoked sturgeon fillet. I salvaged it from the architect's convention. You, can just give us some hors d'oeuvres, murmured Kuravyov cordially as he made himself comfortable in his chair. "I understand," replied Archibald Archibaldovich significantly, closing his eyes. Seeing the treatment these dubious-looking visitors were getting from the boss, the waiters put all their suspicions aside and got down to serious work. One offered a match to Behemoth, who had pulled a butt out of his pocket and stuck it in his mouth. The other flew up to the table with tinkling green glassware and began setting it with liqueur and wine glasses, and those delicate goblets one so enjoyed sipping Narzan from under the awning of the unforgettable Griboyedov veranda. "May I offer you some fillet of grouse?" purred Archibald Archibaldovich musically. The guest in the cracked pince-nez fully concurred with the frigate commander's suggestion and gazed benignly at him through his useless lens. At a neighboring table, the writer, Pietrakov Sukhovier, dining with his wife, who was finishing her escallop of pork, noticed with a writer's keen powers of observation that Archibald Archibaldovich was showering attention on the guests at the next table and was very surprised indeed. But his wife, a most honorable lady, simply became jealous of the pirate's attention to Kuravyov, and even began tapping her spoon on the table as if to say, "What's the delay? It's time for our ice cream. What's the problem?" Archibald Archibaldovich, however, merely gave Madame Pietrakov a seductive smile and sent a waiter over to her, choosing himself to stay with his dear guests. Ah, Archibald Archibaldovich was smart, all right, and not one whit less observant than the writers themselves. Archibald Archibaldovich knew about the performance at the Variety Theatre, and had heard about many of the events that had occurred recently, but unlike everyone else, he had not let the words checked and cat pass unnoticed. He had guessed immediately who his visitors were, and as a result, he naturally had no desire to quarrel with him. But what a prize that Sofia Pavlovna was! Imagine trying to bar those two from the veranda. But what could you expect from her anyway? Haughtily poking her spoon into the melting ice cream, Madame Pietrakov looked on disgruntledly as the table in front of the two apparent buffoons piled up as if by magic with delicacies. Shining, wet lettuce leaves, washed to a sheen, protruded from a bowl of fresh caviar. A minute later, a sweating silver bucket appeared on a small separate table that had been moved over especially for this purpose. Only when he was convinced that everything had been done to perfection, only when the waiters had brought in a bubbling, covered skillet, did Archibald Archibaldovich permit himself to leave the two mysterious visitors, but only after whispering to them, "Excuse me, I'll only be a minute. I want to see to the grouse fillets myself." He flew from the table and disappeared into the inner passageway of the restaurant. If anyone had observed Archibald Archibaldovich's subsequent movements, he would certainly have found them rather mystifying. Rather than head for the kitchen to see to the grouse, the boss went directly to the storeroom. He opened it with his key, locked himself inside, and carefully, so as not to soil his cuffs, removed two heavy, smoked sturgeon from the ice chest, wrapped them up in newspaper, tied them carefully with a string, and put them aside. After that, he checked in the next room to see if his hat and silk-lined summer coat were in their proper place. And only then did he proceed to the kitchen, where the cook was zealously preparing the grouse promised the guests by the pirate. It must be said that there was nothing the least bit strange or mystifying about any of Archibald Archibaldovich's actions, and only a superficial observer could have found them so. Archibald Archibaldovich's actions followed logically from everything that had preceded. His knowledge of recent events, to say nothing of his phenomenal intuition, told the boss of the Griboyedov restaurant that his two visitors' dinner, though lavish and extravagant, would nevertheless be of extremely short duration. And that intuition, which had never deceived the former pirate, did not deceive him now. Just as Korovyov and Behemoth were clinking their second glass of splendid, ice-cold, double-filtered Moscow vodka, the reporter, Boba Kanalupsky, famous in Moscow for his startling omniscience, appeared on the veranda in a state of sweaty excitement and proceeded to join the Pietrakovs at their table. After laying his bulging briefcase on the table, he put his lips to Pietrakov's ear and began whispering some extremely juicy tidbits. Dying of curiosity, Madame Pietrakov also pressed her ear to Boba's puffy, fleshy lips, and he, looking around furtively from time to time, kept on whispering and whispering, and occasionally one could catch a separate word or two, such as, "I swear, Ansadovaya, Sadovaya." Boba lowered his voice even more. "Bullets don't stop them. Bullets, bullets, kerosene, fire, bullets." "They ought to take those liars who spread filthy rumors," bellowed Madame Pietrakov in a louder contralto than Boba would have wished, "and give them a good talking to. Oh, well, never mind. That will happen in good time. They'll be set straight. What vicious liars!" "What liars are you talking about, Antonina Porfirievna?" exclaimed Boba, distressed by her refusal to believe what he was saying. And he began hissing again, "I'm telling you, bullets don't stop them. And now the fire, they flew through the air, the air!" hissed Boba, having no suspicion that the people he was talking about were sitting at the next table and thoroughly enjoying his hissings. However, their enjoyment was short-lived. Three men, coming from inside the restaurant, dashed out on the veranda, their waists tightly buckled, wearing leggings and carrying revolvers. The one in front gave a loud, terrifying shout, "Nobody move!" Then all three opened fire on the veranda aiming at Korovyov's and Behemoth's heads. Both targets immediately dissolved into the air, and a column of flame shot up from the Primus to the awning. A kind of gaping maw with black edges appeared in the awning and began spreading all over it. Leaping through the awning, the fire rose up to the very roof of Griboyedov House. Some folders with papers that were on the second-floor windowsill of the editorial room suddenly burst into flame, followed by the blind, and then the fire, roaring as if someone were fanning it, swept in columns into the ant's house. Just seconds later, writers who had not finished their dinners, the waiters, Sofia Pavlovna, Boba, and the Pietrakovs were running down the asphalt paths out to the iron railings on the boulevard, from whence Ivanushka, the first harbinger of misfortune, who could not get anyone to understand him, had come on Wednesday evening. Having exited through a side door, without running or hurrying, and with time to spare, like a captain obliged to be the last to leave his burning ship, Archibald Archibaldovich stood calmly in his silk-lined summer coat, two logs of smoked balik sturgeon tucked under his arm. Chapter 29. The fate of the Master and Margarita is decided. At sunset, high above the city, on the stone terrace of one of the most beautiful buildings in Moscow, a building built about 150 years ago, were two figures, Volant and Azazello. They could not be seen from below, from the street, since they were shielded from unwelcome stares by a balustrade decorated with stucco vases and stucco flowers. They, on the other hand, could see almost to the very edge of the city. Dressed in his black soutane, Volant was seated on a folding tabouret. His long broadsword had been rammed vertically into the crack between two flagstones, thus forming a sundial. The sword's shadow lengthened slowly and steadily as it crept up to the black slippers on Satan's feet. With his sharp chin resting on his fist and one leg folded beneath him, Volant sat hunched on the tabouret, staring fixedly at the vast assortment of huge buildings, palaces, and shacks condemned to destruction. Azazello had shed his contemporary attire, that is, his jacket, bowler hat, and patent leather shoes, and, like Volant, was dressed in black. He stood motionless, not far from his master, and, like him, stared at the city. Volant spoke. "What an interesting city, don't you think?" Azazello stirred and replied respectfully, "Monsieur, I prefer Rome." "Yes. It's a matter of taste," answered Volant. A short while later his voice sounded again. "What's that smoke over there on the boulevard?"
"That's Griboyedov, burning," replied Azazello.
"One must assume, then, that the inseparable pair, Korovyov and Behemoth, paid them a visit?"
"No doubt about it, monsieur."
Again there was silence, and the two on the terrace watched as the broken, blinding sun caught fire in the westward-facing upper-story windows of the massive buildings. Volant's eye burned like one of those windows, even though he had his back to the sunset. But something made Volant turn away from the city here and focus his attention on the round tower on the roof behind him. Emerging from the tower wall was a somber, mud-stained, black-bearded man wearing a torn chiton and homemade sandals. "Ha!" exclaimed Volant, looking mockingly at the man who had entered. "You're the last person one would have expected to see here. What brings you here, uninvited but expected guest?"
"I've come to see you, spirit of evil and sovereign of the shadows," replied the man, looking sullenly at Volant from under his furrowed brows.
"If you've come to see me, then why haven't you greeted me and wished me well, former tax collector?" said Volant in a stern voice.
"Because I don't want you to be well," was the newcomer's impudent reply.
Nevertheless, you'll have to reconcile yourself to the fact that I am, retorted Voland with a twisted smile. No sooner do you appear on the roof than you blab nonsense. And I'll tell you what it is. It's in your intonation. You pronounced your words as if you refused to acknowledge the existence of either shadows or evil. But would you kindly ponder this question? What would your good do if evil didn't exist? And what would the earth look like if all the shadows disappeared? After all, shadows are cast by things and people. Here is the shadow of my sword. But shadows also come from trees and from living beings. Do you want to strip the earth of all trees and living things? Just because of your fantasy of enjoying naked light? You're stupid.
I won't argue with you, old sophist, replied Levi Matvei.
You can't argue with me because of what I just said. You're stupid, replied Voland, and asked, Well, tell me briefly, without tiring me, why have you appeared?
He sent me.
What did he order you to tell me, slave?
I am not a slave, replied Levi Matvei, becoming more enraged. I am his disciple.
We are speaking different languages, as always, rejoined Voland. But that doesn't change the things we talk about. So?
He has read the Master's work, began Levi Matvei, and asks that you take the Master with you and grant him peace. Is that so difficult for you to do, spirit of evil?
Nothing is difficult for me to do, replied Voland, as you well know.
He was silent for a moment and then added,
But why aren't you taking him with you to the light?
He has not earned light. He has earned peace, said Levi in a sad voice.
Tell him that it shall be done, replied Voland, and added, his eye suddenly flashing, And leave me this instant.
He asks that you also take the one who loved him and who suffered because of him, said Levi to Voland, imploring for the first time.
We would never have thought of that without you. Leave.
Levi Matvei disappeared after this, and Voland called Azazello and commanded him, Fly to them and arrange everything. Azazello left the terrace, and Voland remained alone. But his solitude was not of long duration. Footsteps and animated voices were heard on the terrace, and Karavyov and Behemoth appeared before Voland. But now the fat man was without his primus stove, but was loaded down with other things. Under his arm was a small landscape in a gold frame. Over his arm a badly singed cook's smock, and in his other hand a whole salmon, skin on and tail attached. Karavyov and Behemoth both reeked of smoke. Behemoth's mug was covered with soot, and his cap was half singed.
"Salutations, monsieur," cried the indefatigable pair, and Behemoth waved his salmon.
"You're a fine sight," said Voland.
"Imagine, monsieur," began Behemoth, shouting joyfully and excitedly, "they thought I was a looter."
"Judging by what you've got with you," replied Voland, looking at the landscape, "you are a looter."
"Can you believe, monsieur," began Behemoth in a heartfelt voice.
"No, I can't believe," was Voland's curt reply.
"Monsieur, I swear I made heroic efforts to save everything I could, but this was all I could salvage."
"You would do better to tell me how did Griboyedov catch fire?" asked Voland.
Karavyov and Behemoth both spread their arms and raised their eyes skyward, and Behemoth cried,
"I have no idea. We were sitting peacefully, perfectly quietly, having a bite to eat, and suddenly, bang, bang," chimed in Karavyov. "They were shooting at us, frightened out of our minds. Behemoth and I ran out into the street. The pursuers ran after us, and we made a dash for Timiryatsev. But a sense of duty, inserted Behemoth, overcame our shameful fear, and we went back.
Ah, you went back, did you? Said Voland. So, of course, then the building burned to the ground.
To the ground, affirmed Korovyov sorrowfully. That is, literally to the ground, monsieur, as you so accurately phrased it. Nothing left but smoldering chips. I headed straight, Behemoth recounted, for the assembly hall. That's the one with the columns, monsieur, expecting to save something valuable. Oh, monsieur, my wife, if only I had one, risked being widowed 20 times over. Fortunately, monsieur, I am not married, and I'll tell you frankly, I'm happy not to be. Oh, monsieur, who would exchange the freedom of bachelorhood for a yoke around the neck?
The nonsense has begun again, observed Voland.
I'm listening and continuing with my story, replied the cat. Yes, sir. Here's a small landscape. It was impossible to remove anything else from the hall. The flames were in my face. I ran to the storeroom and salvaged the salmon. Ran to the kitchen and salvaged the smock. I consider, monsieur, that I did everything I could, and I fail to understand the skeptical look on your face.
And what was Korovyov doing while you were looting? Inquired Voland.
I was helping the firemen, monsieur, replied Korovyov, pointing to his torn trousers.
Ah, if that's true, then naturally they'll have to build a new building.
It will be built, monsieur, answered Korovyov. I can assure you of that.
Well, then, all that is left is to hope that the new one will be better than the old, remarked Voland.
And so it shall, monsieur, said Korovyov. Believe me, it will, added the cat. I'm a regular prophet. In any case, we're back, monsieur, reported Korovyov, and we await your instructions.
Voland got up from his taburet, went over to the balustrade, and, turning his back on his retinue, gazed silently into the distance for a long time. Then he went back, sat down on his taburet again, and said, There will be no instructions. You have done everything you could, and for the time being, I have no further need of your services. You may rest. The thunderstorm is coming. The last thunderstorm. And it will accomplish everything that needs to be accomplished. And then we will be on our way.
Very well, monsieur, replied the two buffoons, and disappeared somewhere behind the central round tower in the middle of the terrace.
The thunderstorm that Voland had mentioned was already gathering on the horizon. A black cloud had risen in the west and cut off half the sun. Then it covered it completely. It got cooler on the terrace. Soon thereafter, it got dark. This darkness, which came from the west, enveloped the huge city. Bridges and palaces disappeared. Everything vanished as if it had never existed. A single streak of fire ran across the whole sky. Then a clap of thunder shook the city. It was repeated, and the storm began. Voland ceased to be visible in its darkness.
Chapter 30. Time to go. Time to go. You know, Margarita was saying, just as you fell asleep last night, I was reading about the darkness that had come in from the Mediterranean. And those idols, oh, those golden idols. For some reason, they give me no peace. I think it's going to rain now, too. Can't you feel it getting cooler?
All this is fine and good, replied the master as he smoked and chased the smoke away with his hand. And as for the idols, forget about them. But what will happen next is quite incomprehensible. This conversation took place at sunset, just as Levi Matvei came to Volant on the terrace. The window of the basement apartment was open, and if anyone had glanced in, he would have been taken aback by the strange appearance of the two speakers. Margarita was wearing a black cape over her naked body, and the master was in hospital underclothes. This was because all Margarita's things were back at her house, and she had absolutely nothing else to wear, and although the house was not far away, there was, naturally, no question of her going back there to get her things. And the master, all of whose suits were still in the closet as if he had never been away, simply did not feel like getting dressed, preoccupied as he was with telling Margarita that he was convinced something quite weird was about to happen. True, he was clean-shaven for the first time since that autumn night. His beard had been trimmed with clippers at the clinic. The room looked strange, too, and it was hard to make anything out in all the chaos. There were manuscripts all over the rug and the sofa. A book was splayed spine upwards in the armchair. The round table was set for dinner, and a few bottles stood among the hors d'oeuvres. Neither Margarita nor the master knew where the food and drink had come from. They had awakened to find it all on the table. Having slept until sunset on Saturday, the master and his beloved both felt completely restored, and the only reminder they both had of the previous night's adventures was a slight ache in the left temple. Psychologically, they had both undergone dramatic changes, as anyone who overheard their conversation in the basement apartment would have realized. But there was absolutely no one to overhear them. The good thing about the yard was that it was always empty. The willow and the lindens outside the window were getting greener every day, and their spring fragrance was blown into the basement by a rising breeze. "Well, what the devil!" exclaimed the master unexpectedly. "When you think of it, this is really—" He put out his cigarette in the ashtray and pressed his hands to his head. "No, listen, you're an intelligent person, and you were never crazy. Do you seriously believe that last night we were the guests of Satan?"
"Quite seriously," replied Margarita.
Of course," said the master ironically. "That means that now we have two lunatics here instead of just one, the husband and the wife." He raised his hands to heaven and cried, "No, only the devil knows what this is all about. The devil, the devil, the devil!" Instead of answering, Margarita collapsed on the sofa, burst out laughing, waved her bare legs, and cried out, "Oh, I can't stand it, I can't stand it, if you could only see what you look like." Having laughed her fill while the master sheepishly hitched up his hospital long johns, Margarita then grew serious.
"You just spoke the truth without knowing it," she began. "The devil does know what this is all about. And believe me, the devil will fix everything."
Her eyes suddenly caught fire. She jumped up, began dancing up and down and shouting, "How happy I am! How happy I am that I made that deal with him! Oh, devil! Devil! And you, my dearest, you'll just have to live with a witch." She then rushed over to the master, threw her arms around his neck, and began kissing him on the lips, nose, and cheeks. Streams of uncombed black hair cascaded onto the master, and his cheeks and forehead were hot from kisses. "You really have become like a witch."
"That I don't deny," replied Margarita. "I am a witch, and I'm very pleased to be one."
"Well, good," said the master. "So you're a witch. Fine and splendid. So that means I was abducted from the hospital. Also very nice. They've brought us back here. Let's grant that, too. Let's even assume we won't be missed. But in the name of all that's holy, tell me how we'll live and on what. In saying that, I'm concerned mainly about you, believe me." Just then, a pair of square-toed boots and trouser legs appeared in the basement window. The trousers then bent at the knee, and an ample rear end blocked out the light of day. "Aloisi, are you home?" asked a voice outside the window from somewhere above the trousers. "See, it's beginning," said the master.
"Aloisi?" asked Margarita, going up closer to the window. "He was arrested yesterday, but who's asking for him? What's your name?"
The knees and rear end vanished in a second. The gate made a knocking sound, after which everything returned to normal. Margarita collapsed on the sofa and laughed so hard that tears rolled down her cheeks. But when she had calmed down, her face changed completely. She began speaking seriously, and as she did, she slid down off the couch and crawled over to the master's knees. And looking into his eyes, she began stroking his head.
"How you've suffered. How you've suffered, my poor man. I'm the only one who knows how much. Look, you have streaks of gray in your hair and a permanent line by your mouth. My only one, my darling, don't think about anything. You've had to think too much, and now I'll do the thinking for you. And I promise, everything will be spectacularly fine."
"I'm not afraid of anything, Margot," replied the master suddenly. And he raised his head and looked just as he had when he was writing about what he had never seen but knew for certain had happened. "I'm not afraid because I've already been through everything. They frightened me too much, and they can't frighten me with anything else. But I feel sorry for you, Margot. That's the problem. And that's why I keep coming back to the same thing. Come to your senses. Why ruin your life over a sick man and a beggar? Go back home. I feel pity for you. That's why I'm saying this." "Oh, you, you," whispered Margarita, shaking her disheveled head. "You unhappy man of little faith. I spent last night naked and shivering because of you. I lost my entire nature and became something different. For months I sat in a dark hole of a room thinking about only one thing, the thunderstorm over Yerushalayim. I cried my eyes out, and now, when happiness has come, you want to chase me away? Well, fine, I'll go. But know that you are a cruel man. They ravaged your soul." Bitter tenderness welled up in the master's heart. And for some unknown reason, he began to cry as he buried his head in Margarita's hair. She whispered to him, crying, and her fingers skipped lightly over the master's temples.
"Yes, streaks, streaks. Your head is turning snow white before my very eyes. Oh, my long-suffering head. Just look at your eyes. There's a wasteland in there. And your shoulders, they're weighted down. They've crippled you. Crippled you."
Margarita's speech was disjointed. She was shaking with tears. Then the master wiped his eyes, lifted Margarita off her knees, got up himself, and said in a firm voice, "Enough. You've put me to shame. I won't let myself be faint-hearted anymore. And I won't bring up the subject again. Don't worry. I know we're both victims of a mental illness that I may have given you. Well, no matter. We'll go through it together." Margarita pressed her lips to the master's ear and whispered,
"I swear by your life. I swear by the astrologer's son, divined by you, that everything will be all right."
"Well, fine, fine," answered the master, adding with a laugh, "Of course, when people have been stripped of everything, as you and I have been, they look to otherworldly powers for salvation. Well, all right, I'm willing to do that."
"That's it. Now you're your old self again. You're laughing," replied Margarita. "To the devil with your learned words. Otherworldly or not otherworldly, isn't it all the same? I'm hungry."
And she took the master's hand and pulled him over to the table. "I'm not convinced that the food won't fall through the floor or fly out the window," said the master, who was now completely calm.
"It won't fly away."
And at that moment, a nasal voice was heard at the window.
"Peace be unto you."
The master shuddered, but Margarita, already accustomed to the unusual, cried out,
"That must be Azazello. Oh, how nice this is, how good!"
And she whispered to the master,
you see, they haven't forsaken us."
She hurried to open the door. "Pull your cape around you," the master called after her.
"I don't give a damn about that," replied Margarita, already out in the little hallway.
And then Azazello was bowing and greeting the master, his wall-eye beaming at him, and Margarita exclaimed,
"Oh, how happy I am! I've never been so happy in my life. But please excuse my nakedness, Azazello."
Azazello told her not to worry, assuring her that he had seen not only naked women, but women who had been completely skinned. And he took a seat at the table after first placing a bundle wrapped in dark brocade in the corner by the stove. Margarita poured Azazello some cognac, and he drank it gladly. Not taking his eyes off him, the master would now and then quietly pinch his left wrist under the table. But the pinching did not help. Azazello did not evaporate into thin air, and, to tell the truth, there was no reason for him to do so. There was nothing terrifying about this short, red-haired man, except perhaps for his wall eye, but such things can occur even without sorcery, or except perhaps for his not quite normal clothes, some kind of cassock or cloak, but then again, if one thinks about it seriously, there are people who dress like that. And he drank his cognac as all good men do, that is, downing each glass in one swallow, without eating anything. That same cognac made the master's head buzz. And he began thinking, no, Margarita's right. Of course this fellow in front of me is an emissary of the devil. After all, wasn't I just trying to prove to Ivan 2 nights ago that it was Satan whom he had met at Patriarch's Ponds? But now, for some reason, the thought frightens me, and I start babbling about hypnotists and hallucinations. What the devil kind of hypnotists are these? He began examining Azazello closely, and became convinced that some constraint showed in his eyes, some idea which he had not as yet proposed to them. He's not here just to pay a visit. He's here on some mission, thought the master. His powers of observation had not betrayed him. After downing a third glass of cognac, which seemed to have no effect on Azazello whatsoever, the visitor began as follows.
A devilishly comfy little basement. I have only one question. What are you going to do in this little basement?
That's precisely what I was saying, replied the master, laughing.
Why are you upsetting me, Azazello? Asked Margarita. We'll manage somehow.
Please, please, cried Azazello. I never meant to upset you. I even agree with you. You'll manage somehow. Oh, yes, I almost forgot. Monsieur sends his greetings. He also asked that I invite you to go on a little outing with him, if, of course, you wish to. So, what do you say to that?
Margarita nudged the master with her foot under the table. I accept with pleasure, replied the master, studying Azazello, while the latter continued,
We hope Margarita Nikolaevna won't refuse our invitation.
Of course I won't, said Margarita, again nudging the master's foot with her own.
That's wonderful, exclaimed Azazello. That's what I like. 1, 2, and we're off. Not like that time in Alexandrovsky Park.
Oh, don't remind me, Azazello. I was stupid then. But I shouldn't be blamed too severely. After all, it's not every day you meet up with an evil power.
That's for sure, confirmed Azazello. How nice it would be if it were every day.
It's the speed I like, said Margarita excitedly. The speed and the nakedness. Like a shot from a Mauser. Bang! Ah, what a shot he is, cried Margarita, turning to the master. He can hit a 7 card underneath a pillow and on any of its markings. Margarita was starting to get drunk, which made her eyes flash.
And again I forgot something, said Azazello loudly, slapping himself on the forehead. I must be overtired. Monsieur sent you a gift.
Here he turned to the master.
A bottle of wine. Please note that it's the same wine the procurator of Judea was drinking. Falernum.
Naturally, such a rarity provoked the master's and Margarita's interest. Azazello took a moldy jug out of a piece of dark funeral brocade. They sniffed the wine, poured it into glasses, and looked through it at the light in the window, which was fading in the approaching storm. They saw how everything was stained the color of blood.
To Volant's health, exclaimed Margarita, raising her glass.
All three touched their lips to their glasses and took a long drink. The pre-storm light began to fade in the master's eyes. His heart skipped a beat, and he felt the end approaching. He saw Margarita now mortally pale, helplessly stretch out her hands to him, drop her head on the table, and then slide to the floor. "Poisoner!" the master managed to shout. He wanted to grab a knife from the table to stab Azazello, but his hand slid helplessly off the tablecloth. Everything around him in the basement turned black and then vanished completely. He fell backwards, and as he did, cut his temple on the corner of the desk. When the two who had been poisoned were still, Azazello went into action. The first thing he did was dash to the window, and seconds later, he was in the house where Margarita Nikolaevna had lived. Always careful and precise, Azazello wanted to make sure that everything that was necessary had been done. Everything was completely in order. He saw a morose woman who was waiting for her husband to come home walk out of her bedroom, suddenly turn pale, clutch her heart, and cry out helplessly, "Natasha, someone, help me!" She fell on the living room floor without reaching the study.
"Everything's in order," said Azazello.
A minute later, he was back with the prostrate lovers. Margarita lay with her face buried in the carpet. With his iron grip, Azazello turned her over like a doll so that she was facing him and scrutinized her. The face of the poisoned woman changed before his eyes. Even in the dusk of the gathering storm, he could see the temporary witch's squint and the cruelty and wildness of her features disappear. The dead woman's face brightened and finally softened, and her smile was no longer predatory, but more that of a woman who had gone through a lot of suffering. Then Azazello pried open her white teeth and poured a few drops into her mouth of the same wine he had used to poison her. Margarita sighed, started to raise herself without Azazello's help, sat up, and asked in a weak voice,
"Why, Azazello, why? What have you done to me?"
She saw the master lying there, shuddered, and whispered, "I didn't expect this. Murderer."
"No, no, you've got it all wrong," replied Azazello. "He'll get up in a minute. Why are you so nervous?"
The red-haired demon sounded so convincing that Margarita believed him right away. She jumped up, strong and alive, and helped give the prostrate master a drink of the wine. Opening his eyes, the latter gave a glowering look and with hatred in his voice repeated his last word, "Poisoner."
"Ah, well, insults are the usual reward for good work," replied Azazello. "Are you blind? If so, recover your sight quickly."
The master lifted himself up, looked around with bright, keen eyes, and asked, "What does this new scenario mean?"
"It means," replied Azazello, "that it's time for us to go. Can't you hear the thunder? It's getting dark. The horses are pawing the ground. Your little garden is trembling. Say goodbye to your basement and do it quickly."
"Ah, I see," said the master, looking around. "You killed us. We're dead. How clever of you. How timely. Now I understand everything."
"Oh, please," replied Azazello. "Is that you I'm hearing? After all, your beloved calls you the master. You are thinking at this moment, how can you be dead? Do you have to be sitting in a basement in a shirt and hospital long johns to think you're alive? That's absurd."
"I understand what you've said," cried the master. "Don't say any more. You're 1,000 times right."
"Great Voland," seconded Margarita. "Great Voland. His idea was a lot better than mine. But the novel," she shouted to the master. "Take the novel with you wherever you're flying."
"I don't have to," replied the master. "I remember it by heart."
"But you won't forget a word of it? Not a single word?"
asked Margarita, pressing herself to her lover and wiping the blood away from the cut on his temple. "Don't worry. Now I shall never forget anything," he replied.
"Then it's time for the fire," cried Azazello. "Fire with which everything began and with which we are ending everything."
"Fire!"
shouted Margarita in a terrifying voice. The basement window banged. The wind blew the blind aside. A short burst of thunder clapped merrily in the sky. Azazello thrust his clawed hand into the stove, pulled out a smoking log, and set fire to the tablecloth. Then he set fire to a bundle of old newspapers on the couch.
and then to the manuscript and the curtain on the window. The master, already intoxicated by the thought of the coming ride, threw a book from the shelf onto the table and ruffled its pages in the burning tablecloth. It went up in merry flames. "Burn! Burn, former life! Burn, suffering!" cried Margarita. The room was already shimmering in crimson columns, and the three of them ran out through the door along with the smoke, up the stone stairs and out into the yard. The first thing they saw was the landlord's cook sitting on the ground. Scattered around her were potatoes and several bunches of onions. The cook's condition was understandable. Three black horses were snorting by the shed, quivering, and kicking up fountains of dirt. Margarita was the first to mount, then Azazello and the master last. The cook let out a groan and was about to lift her hand to make the sign of the cross, but Azazello shouted threateningly from the saddle, "I'll cut your hand off!" He whistled, and the horses soared upwards, smashing the linden branches, and dove into a black, low-hanging cloud. Just then, smoke began pouring out of the tiny basement window. From below came the faint, pathetic cry of the cook, "We're on fire!" The horses were already flying over the roofs of Moscow. "I want to say goodbye to the city," shouted the master to Azazello, who was riding in front. Thunder swallowed up the end of the master's sentence. Azazello nodded and urged his horse into a gallop. A cloud was coming straight toward the riders, but still without a sprinkle of rain. They flew over the boulevard, looked down, and saw tiny figures running all over the place, seeking shelter from the rain. The first drops began to fall. They flew over the smoke, which was all that was left of Griboyedov. They flew over the city being flooded by darkness. Lightning flashed above them. Then the rooftops gave way to greenery. Only then did the rain gush down and transform them into three huge bubbles in the deluge. Margarita was already used to the sensation of flight, but the master was not, and he was amazed at how quickly they reached their destination, where the man was whom he wanted to say goodbye to because he had no one else. Through the veil of rain, he immediately recognized Stravinsky's clinic, the river, and the wood on the opposite shore that he had come to know so thoroughly. They landed in a grove in the meadow not far from the clinic.
"I'll wait for you here," shouted Azazello through cupped hands, now lit up by flashes of lightning, now submerged in a shroud of gray. "Say goodbye, but do it quickly."
The master and Margarita jumped down from their saddles and flew across the clinic garden, flickering like watery shadows. A moment later, the master's practiced hand was moving aside the balcony grill of room 117. Margarita was right behind him. They entered Ivanushka's room, invisible and unnoticed, while the storm was crashing and howling. The master stopped by the bed. Ivanushka lay motionless, just as he had the first time he watched a thunderstorm from this haven of rest. But he was not crying now as he had been then. After looking carefully at the dark silhouette that had entered his room from the balcony, he raised himself up, stretched his arms out, and said joyfully, "Ah, it's you! I've been waiting and waiting for you, and now here you are, my neighbor." To this the master replied, "I am here, but unfortunately I cannot be your neighbor anymore. I am flying away forever, and I have only come to say goodbye." "I knew that. I guessed it," replied Ivan softly, and asked, "Did you meet him?"
"Yes," said the master. "I came to say goodbye to you because you are the only person I've talked to recently."
Ivanushka brightened and said, "It's good that you stopped by. I'll keep my word, you know. I won't write any more silly poems. Something else interests me now." Ivanushka smiled and stared with crazed eyes into the distance past the master. "I want to write something else. While I've been lying here, you know, I've come to understand a great deal." These words excited the master, and he sat down on the edge of Ivanushka's bed and began speaking. "That's good. That's good. You'll write the sequel about him." Ivanushka's eyes flashed. "But won't you be writing that yourself?" Here he lowered his head and added thoughtfully, "Ah, yes, of course. Why am I asking such things?" Ivanushka gazed down at the floor, looking frightened.
"No," said the master, and his voice sounded unfamiliar and hollow.
I won't be writing about him anymore. I'll be busy with something else. A distant whistle pierced through the sound of the storm.
Do you hear that?
Asked the master. The noise of the storm?
No. They're calling me. It's time for me to go, explained the master and got up from the bed.
Wait, one more word, begged Ivan. Did you find her? Had she been faithful?
She's right here, replied the master and pointed to the wall.
A dark Margarita detached herself from the white wall and came over to the bed. She looked at the young man lying there, and sorrow showed in her eyes. My poor, poor dear, whispered Margarita almost soundlessly, and she bent over the bed. What a beautiful woman, said Ivan, without envy, but with sadness and a kind of quiet tenderness. You see, everything worked out well for you. But it didn't for me. Here he thought for a minute and added pensively, But maybe it has.
Yes, yes, whispered Margarita, bending down to him. I'm going to kiss you on the forehead, and everything will work out as it should. Take my word for it. I've seen everything already. I know everything.
The young man put his arms around her neck, and she kissed him.
Farewell, disciple,
said the master, barely audibly, and began melting into the air. He vanished, and Margarita vanished with him. The balcony grill closed. Ivanushka became restless. He sat up in bed, looked around anxiously, even groaned, began talking to himself, and then got up. The thunderstorm was raging with increasing fury and, apparently, had agitated his soul. It also upset him that his ears, accustomed now to perpetual silence, caught the sounds of anxious footsteps and muffled voices coming from outside his door. In a nervous state, he called out, trembling, Praskovya Fyodorovna! As she came into his room, Praskovya Fyodorovna gave Ivanushka an anxious and inquiring glance.
What is it? What's the matter? She asked. Is the storm upsetting you? Well, never you mind. Never you mind. We'll make you feel better right away. I'll call for the doctor.
No, Praskovya Fyodorovna, you don't have to call for the doctor, said Ivanushka, looking restlessly, not at Praskovya Fyodorovna, but at the wall. There's nothing particularly the matter. I understand everything now. Don't be afraid. But won't you tell me, asked Ivan with feeling, what just happened next door, in room 118?
In 118?
Repeated Praskovya Fyodorovna, and her eyes began darting all around.
Why, nothing happened there.
But her voice sounded fake. Ivanushka noticed that immediately and said, Oh, Praskovya Fyodorovna, you're such a truthful person. Do you think I'm going to fly into a rage?
No, Praskovya Fyodorovna, that won't happen. Why don't you just tell me? I can sense what's going on through the wall anyway. Your neighbor just died, whispered Praskovya Fyodorovna, unable to overcome her innate truthfulness and goodness. And clothed in the brilliance of the lightning, she looked in fear at Ivanushka. But nothing terrible happened to Ivanushka. He simply raised his finger meaningfully and said, I knew it. I can assure you, Praskovya Fyodorovna, someone else just died in the city. I even know who. Here, Ivanushka smiled mysteriously. It was a woman.
This ends Disc 14. The Master and Margarita, Disc 15.
Chapter 31. On Sparrow Hills. The thunderstorm had passed without leaving a trace, and a multicolored rainbow had formed an arch over the entire city and was drinking water from the Moscow River. High on a hill between two groves of trees, three dark silhouettes could be seen. Volant, Karavyov, and Behemoth sat mounted on black horses, gazing at the city that stretched out on the other side of the river, at the fragmented sun gleaming in the thousands of windows facing westward toward the gingerbread towers of Novodevichy Convent.
There was a rustle in the air, and Azazello, along with the master and Margarita, who were flying behind him in the black tail of his cloak, landed next to the waiting group.